47 Blaze 1 and 1 1½ respond code 3 an additional unit.
931, shots fired in the bar. Shots fired.
From the source for law enforcement, this is the Officer.com podcast. News, interviews, and discussions for today's cops. Your host is the editor-in-chief of Officer.com, Tim Deeds.
Welcome to Officer.com's very first podcast. As that snazzy intro already told you, I'm Tim Deeds, the editor-in-chief of Officer.com, and I'm doing this because I couldn't talk anyone else into it. These podcasts are a new venture. We're open to new ideas. I am hoping that we'll have some weekly commentary and possibly an interview or two with interesting folks in law enforcement. If there's something you'd like to see included in a future podcast, even if it's yourself, feel free to drop me a note at editor@officer.com. There is also a place on the podcast download page where you can leave comments and questions. Officer.com is not a huge bureaucracy. Most of the news, or rather the non-news content, comes from or through me, and I see and respond to every message and comment personally. This podcast focuses on a topic near and dear to my heart. The American Society of Law Enforcement Trainers, or ASLET, survived for 20 years, more or less. At its peak, it was far and away the predominant police training organization in the world. It had a highly successful annual conference, a magazine, and a rack of member benefits. But in 2006, it closed its doors. There was significant turmoil within the organization during the last few years, and some claim that the infighting continued through the entire history of the organization, just becoming more pronounced here and there. There were three executive directors over the years, plus a few others that performed the executive director duties but didn't have the title. In the interest of full disclosure, I need to tell you that I was an active ASLET member from 1989 until the organization collapsed. My first regular writing gig was a computer column for what was then the ASLET Journal. I was a presenter at a number of annual seminars, and I became the designated geek to run the sound, lights, and visuals at the various general ceremonies and meetings. I was one of the original members of the Ethics Committee, and eventually its chair, and I was elected to the Board of Directors in 2003 and served in that position until my term expired in 2005. I was also one of the lucky folks named as a defendant in a federal RICO action brought by two other members of the Board of Directors. RICO is short for the Racketeer-Influenced Corrupt Organizations Act, if you didn't know, and it's normally reserved for situations involving organized crime. Like a lot of other things in police work, some of the best people and worst people I've ever met were in ASLET. Our interview is with Pat Martin. He chaired the ASLET Board of Directors starting in January 2006, and he's technically still the chair, as the corporation has not been formally dissolved. Pat is a lieutenant with the Greenfield, Wisconsin Police Department, and I'm also glad to call him my friend. Well, Pat, thank you for being my first victim on the very first Officer.com podcast.
My pleasure.
Well, get into this. I'm not sure where you want to start this history, but when did you join the ASLET Board of Directors?
In mid to late of 2004, I believe, August, I believe, of 04.
And since the elections are generally held in December with the installation of officers in January, how come you came on at kind of an odd time?
I was appointed by the then board of directors, or asked if I would be interested, and was appointed by them, and then eventually ran and was elected in January of 05.
So what was the situation for ASLET then?
I would say it was tumultuous. At the time that, in August of 04, at the time I was appointed by the board, the executive director, as I recall, had not held board meetings for months.
Now, that was Frank Hackett at that time, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Several other directors resigned additionally. We needed to plan for the 2005 seminar, which was coming up in short months. Needed to get a magazine out. Van, and I don't remember the position he held at the time, also resigned, and Aslett was embroiled in a bunch of lawsuits, I would say, by a board member against other board members. So I would say it was in turmoil.
What were the lawsuits about?
I believe one of them was a federal RICO Act accusing several of the board members of conspiring against the membership at whole. And again, I would have to review it. It's a rather lengthy document to really get into the specifics.
Weren't there some other legal actions concerning release of documents or something like that?
There was, well, like I said, they were embroiled in lawsuits. There were lawsuits against Aslett and the board for open records, I believe, releasing financial documents. And as I recall, every time documents were given, it was never enough or never what was needed, and then more lawsuits, more legal action. And as I recall, it was a rather expensive venture.
If I remember correctly, the legal bills that were coming in for answering those lawsuits ran well into six figures.
Yeah, my best recollection, and again, most of these were already paid for, already, I would guess, well in the billing stages before I got there, was nearly $250,000.
Okay. Well, talking about money, at various times during Aslett's courts, there were some accusations of financial mismanagement, and I think those were made of every executive director and the people that followed the executive directors that didn't have the title, with the exception of Ed Nowicki. And I want to make it real clear that nobody ever accused Ed of doing anything bad. But the other executive directors and people that served in that capacity, at one time or another, seemed like they were accused of those things. Was there actually any mismanagement of money, and if so, was it intentional, or was it incompetence or unintentional accident, or what was the story on that?
Well, in my opinion, and mind you, I've been around Aslett since its inception. I was a charter member, attended every conference that we had, and I've seen, you know, the workings rather intimately the last few years, but I think during the time that Ed Nowicki was executive director, everything was moving fine. We were moving up as an organization and really, I think, doing very well. It seemed at some point in time after Ed resigned from his position as executive director, and that was a personal decision, as I recall, because he had family and work things that had to be taken care of, and it was nothing to do with anyone in Aslett. But it seemed like after that point in time, then all these accusations came up. And you're right, Tim, it seemed like everybody involved in that position at one point in time was accused of it after Ed Nowicki left.
So with hindsight, do you think that there actually was any mismanagement? Was it intentional?
I would say, and again, this is just my opinion, I would say that, now mind you, you know, these are people who were cops brought in to run a organization. I would say if anything happened, it would be inexperience and inability to really deal with corporations the way that many corporations are dealt with. I don't believe there was any really mismanagement. I think a lot of it may have been just an opinion as to how things should be run, where money should be spent, what benefits should be given, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think there was any intentional or criminal acts committed by any of the executive directors or those in their stead.
So in the course of all this, I know there were a lot of accusations and names and charges thrown around. Was anyone actually accused of a crime or formally charged with a crime in any of this?
I don't believe there were any formal charges ever filed, criminal charges ever filed anywhere.
Do you know of any situations where they could have been and they just weren't?
I really don't.
Okay. Tell us about that that RICO Act lawsuit, and I've already explained that I was a named defendant in that lawsuit, so... I remember vividly, and we just got out of that last December. But can you give me some idea of what brought that about? Because that's kind of an unusual thing for a professional association to be dealing with.
It was very weird, and it was beyond, I'd say almost beyond most people's comprehension that that would be brought against ASLIT or its board. My understanding, and again, I was not fortunately named in that suit, so I don't have all the details of it, but my understanding is that at some point in time, one of the members, and I don't recall if he was a director at the time, was voted out of membership, and then that was rescinded, which I think was another lawsuit that brought that about. And I believe that member felt that board members were conspiring to, keep benefits from other members and keep him off the board. And I think that's the gist of how it came about.
In the end, what happened with all that? There were lots of charges, and as you've alluded, we both know that was a really long charging document. So with all of the stuff that that was alleged in the charging document, how was the case disposed of, whatever happened with it?
I believe the case was dismissed. There were no charges ever filed, no federal charges filed. It just disappeared. We spent a lot of money, we meaning ASLIT, spent a lot of money defending it, and there was nothing in the end that, in my opinion, there is no base for the lawsuit to start with, but it's a shame.
Yeah. Okay, this puts you on the spot because you were the secretary during this time, but for most of 2005, there were no board minutes published, and I was one of the people that was a little more vocal than most about wanting to see those, and they weren't there, and I'm wondering, that I know the board was meeting regularly, what happened to the minutes?
That's a really good question. Like I mentioned to you before, I was the secretary. I was taking the notes and putting them on the computer, trying to send them out to people. And at some point in time, I changed computers. Some of the notes were lost, and I had to try and redo them. As far as publishing them and getting them on the web, I would say up until mid to late 05, I didn't even think about putting them there. I know we had for a long time put them on there, and I think eventually we did put some more on there, but I'll be honest, it just never crossed my mind to have them put on the web.
Okay. There was a very active ASLIC Ethics Committee, and I know how active it was because I was involved with it from the beginning, that was formed somewhere around 1995 with Neil Troutman as the chair at that time, and then it continued under another chair, Bill Westfall, and eventually I wound up being the chair. And then in 2000, it was dissolved by the board of directors. And I know that we handled a lot of allegations at that time. There were allegations and cross allegations and cross complaints and people getting mad at each other and so on. Do you have any recollection or have any knowledge personally as to why that that committee was dissolved?
I really don't. Can't help you out on this one.
Okay.
I just don't.
Well, can't. Is this,
we can revisit later if I look up more info, but I off the top of my brain, it's drawing
a
blank.
And this is the Pat. This is the Pat Martin, I do not recall, not the Alberto Gonzalez, I don't recall,
yes,
right?
Yes,
okay.
Pat Martin, I really don't have a clue.
Okay. Well, when that went away, and this kind of goes into your era on the board, there were several subsequent episodes where one or more members accused others of misconduct, and charges were either investigated or not investigated or ignored, or and there were even some dispositions. So what happened with that? Why were those handled differently?
I really don't know why it was investigated differently other than we did not have an ethics committee. And I believe the bylaws at the time, the way they read, was some would request that the board would bring charges, the board would look into something, and the board would then bring charges and either have something looked into or investigated. Although now that I'm saying this, I think the investigation term was a point of contention with some of the board members as well. But it was looked into and tried to come up with a resolution, as I recall, or at least an outcome, whether the charges were sustained or denied.
So at its peak, ASLET had somewhere around 7,000 members, and that's a figure I'm going on from strictly from memory here. I don't, I don't remember precisely, and if you do, please correct me. And had over 800 people at the largest conference, and actually the attendance rates, except for some that were in places really far away, where it was generally a very well-attended conference. So when did ASLET start to decline?
I really couldn't point a year on it, but I could kind of do an era of it. And I would say the era of the lawsuits against board members, as well as bad publicity. There were websites out there that were operated or registered to one of the board members' wives, and also one of the board members' businesses that would make references to these same websites. And there's a lot of misinformation on those sites, a lot of bad press, if you will, that, as I always called them, wide-based, baseless allegations that, you know, much like the RICO lawsuit, nothing ever came to fruition of the allegations that were on the website. And I think people really got tired of the infighting. I've talked to several people who had attended seminars or were involved in ASLET and would be getting mailings from board members and asking me, you know, what's going on, what's the big deal, you know, very curious as to why there was such turmoil within the board itself. And I think that just had a great trickle-down effect, and people just became disinterested and didn't want to be involved in an organization where there's so much turmoil.
So it was more the infighting of the organization than the job that it was doing or the services it provided?
Oh, I believe so. I've attended ASLET, like I said, every seminar, and have done so as a innocent observer, if you will, and have done so as a volunteer member and then also as a board member, and have found that those who attend the conference who really know nothing about the inner workings or any of the inner turmoil find the conference to be an absolute wow. Those who see the magazine, the law enforcement trainer, the same thing. If your membership consists of attending a seminar, reading the magazine, and getting some of the info from ASLET, it's a great thing. But if you start, you know, getting bombarded with some of the bad publicity or some of the, you know, allegations and innuendos, you become very disinterested. So I don't think it was the seminar. It was not the magazine itself. It was the infighting.
Do you think that there was a single reason or a single incident or a single person that this revolved around, or, you know, was it a combination of factors?
You really want to put me on the spot, don't you? I would say, actually, it's a combination of a multiple issues and multiple people. You have a board of directors of a nonprofit that is trying to manage an organization with an executive director and trying to give guidance. And if there's turmoil within the board, then the executive director is sometimes not able to fulfill his duties as he should, especially if you get conflicting messages from the board. And then you have a certain board member who, for whatever reason, seemed to think the worst of any executive director after Ed. and that there was always something wrong. And I think that's where the allegations came from. That's where a lot of the rumors came from. So it was multiple things, but I think, you know, there's also a single person who really pushed the issues.
Well, if there was a single person, and you've made reference to a board member, and I think we both know who you're talking to, and we'll just leave that lie. But why did
one, it would be the one who was not sued?
Why or how did this person remain on the board? It had to be apparent to some people that that this person was at the foundation of all the problems. So how did they stay there?
Good question. Like anything, particularly in our democratic society, you have elections. And elections can be influenced by many things, but very, very few percentage, or I'm sorry, a very small percentage of the members actually vote. And I believe that director owned a school, and a very good school, and had a lot of followers and was able to get the people there to vote. When you have a high percentage of your followers voting compared with a low percentage of the entire membership, I think that's how he kept getting on, and some of his followers as well.
Was there a moment that you knew that we've jumped the shark, that we passed the point of no return, that, you know, that there's just no point in going on?
In my opinion, it was the point when three or four of the board members filed a complaint against Aslett to file for bankruptcy. That was March or April of 06, I believe.
I've always wondered about that a little bit. How can a non-majority of the board try to bring the organization that they are the board of into bankruptcy? How can that be done without the advice and consent of at least the majority of the board, if not the membership?
Well, originally it hadn't. In January of 06, the Albuquerque seminar spent more than we brought in, put us in the red, and that created a problem for us. Some of the board members immediately wanted to file for bankruptcy. Chapter 11, Chapter 7, and I looked into it, and I was directed by the board to do so. So I looked into it further. I contacted attorneys who I know and contacted attorneys who are well-versed in bankruptcy law in Delaware that I had no contact with, had no reason to know, and asked for their advice. And the advice I got from all the attorneys were filing for bankruptcy is a bad idea. A, we didn't have the money to do so, and B, we could never survive it. So I brought that information back to the board. I think the board, again, wanted me to, I forgot if it was contact or another attorney, but after several meetings of this, I reported that there was the best interest of Aslett was not served by filing bankruptcy in the opinion of the attorneys, which they directed me to contact, but that wasn't good enough. And three or four of the board members, I believe, filed a complaint in, I believe, the Court of Chancery to try and force Aslett into bankruptcy. And that, I think, was the point where you just can't fight it. You know, we had no money to fight lawsuits. It was just at that, to me, was a breaking point.
What was the advice of the attorneys if it wasn't to file bankruptcy? What did they recommend you do since the organization was in the red?
We had a seminar that was planned for December of 06. That was going to be the 20th in Orlando, Florida. And it was going to be a big gala. We had a really good deal with Single Creek Resorts, which is a premier resort down in Orlando. A lot of the amenities that people had come to Aslett for, the hospitality, the training, everything was going to be there. It was going to be a, in my opinion, was going to be a knockout. And there, the advice of the attorneys was to press for the seminar because the seminars, if watched properly, can make a significant amount of money for the organization. They also recommended doing a membership drive. And they also recommended contacting all of the creditors, telling them, this is what we are doing, this is what we are planning. Will you take X percent at a time until we can pay it off? And that was their recommendation.
Had that been followed, Aslett might have survived that storm.
I believe we could have.
Okay. But the road not taken.
And Aslett eventually did file for bankruptcy because the treasurer at the time was also getting calls. And the treasurer at the time was taking phone calls from creditors. And we ended up filing for bankruptcy, in my opinion, because the threat of the unknown, which was one of the board members kept threatening that individual directors would be liable. He'd bring up websites with information on it, yet if you looked at the cases that he cited, it actually showed that individual board members would not be it. As a matter of fact, the board members should be more liable to the shareholders, which in our case would have been the membership, instead of the creditors. But I think the fear of that and worrying about, again, more lawsuits, we ended up having a majority vote to file for bankruptcy.
So technically, is the organization still in bankruptcy?
I believe it's been filed. I know it's been filed. It went to court fall of last year, and I think it was disposed of.
So is there still technically an Aslett? Has the board met to dissolve the corporation, or is that not happened yet?
That I don't believe that's happened yet. I haven't actually even heard any of the finals from the court itself.
So you're still the captain of a sinking ship.
They're sunk.
Here's maybe a philosophical question for you. Before Aslett, there was the Justice Systems Training Association, JSTA.
I remember that as well.
And that one kind of imploded. Aslett lasted close to 20 years. I guess technically it did. It lasted over 20 years. And now we have ILETA, an organization that we're both members of, and we spoke at the last conference, and I think we both agree that, you know, it's a fine outfit and we get a lot out of it. But knowing what you know, with the benefit of hindsight, do you think this is just the way that law enforcement training organizations are, the path that they have to take, and if so, why? Because it strikes me as odd that nobody can seem to make one of these organizations work.
Well, I think Aslett worked for a good long time. But as you said, in the end, it ended up the way it did. A couple things come into play. You have police officers. Now you add that police trainers. And I think you're going to have all the type A personalities with the egos that go with it in competition in and of itself, and that can cause some turmoil. But I think one of Aslett's downfalls was, unfortunately, the good intention of Ed when he started Aslett was a nonprofit corporation. And it's a great idea, but having a board run this type of business, I just don't think works. And in the end, I think that overall that was its biggest downfall, because they were unable to keep the direction that Ed Nowicki gave it to start with. ILETA, I think, as long as Ed Nowicki is in charge, or Harvey Hedden, the people who are running it now, and they have an advisory board. It's not, they don't make law, they don't run the, you know, organization, they're an advisory board, and I think that will work much better.
I said in an editorial a couple of months back after the last ILETA seminar that ILETA is a benevolent dictatorship, but that's okay because everybody likes the dictator.
Good point.
And I like the dictator too. And, you know, I think he's, you know, we both know that, you know, Ed's a terrific guy, and I don't know if anybody's got anything bad to say about him.
Oh, I agree.
But does it have to be that way? Do you have to find, you know, some saint-like character to carry the organization, or are cops or trainers, cop trainers, whatever, incapable of managing an organization?
I think you have to find the one person or group of people who have the charisma, who have that leadership ability. It's like any great leader. And when you have a group of hard-charging trainers all with the same goal of saving cops' lives, but sometimes different thoughts on how to do it, you need that strong leadership. And I think it does take a special person or group of persons to run an organization like this.
Is there an element where trainers, at least at face value, they're out there to save cops' lives, but in fact they have some different agenda?
Oh, I think there's plenty of trainers who, in my opinion, get in the business to start, you know, on that track of saving lives. But there's plenty who are in the field to make a buck. I mean, that's clear when you walk through the seminar and see some of the training that's being put on. Some of it is more of a dog and pony show for their school or their type of training, and the trade show part of it, where all the vendors are, you know, that's the same thing. I mean, they're selling a product and selling things to help us do our job better, and everybody, I think, a lot of people have their own agenda that isn't necessarily the same as everybody else's.
Well, true. You know, and I'm working for an organization that, you know, is one of those people on the trade show floor. I'd like to think that it's possible to make a buck and actually provide a service for law enforcement, but I suppose it depends on where the emphasis is and who the people are that are making the directions for the organization. Any predictions for ILEADA's future or advice for its leadership?
Keep on doing what it's doing. I think, like I said before, with Ed and or Harvey in charge and running the organization, I think it's great. And always keep in mind the goal, you know, as let's motto was to keep the walls bare, that being the walls of the Law Enforcement Officer Memorial. And I think as long as you can keep that true to heart and keep that as your sole mission and vision, I think the rest goes with it.
Well, Pat, I've always known you to be invested in that ideal, and I really do appreciate you taking the time to share your thoughts with us on this. I know it's been something that many people just wondered, you know, what the hell happened when they didn't really know what was going on within the organization.
Oh, I agree, and I think in retrospect, I think one of the things maybe we could have done, and of course I didn't think of it till much later, and it would have cost money, was shortly after January, probably February even, when we really found out our true financial situation. In retrospect, I think had we reached out to the membership and said, this is what it is, real plain and simple, and this is what we need, I think people would have stepped up to the plate.
It's, again, the road not taken.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, again, thanks, Pat, and I really appreciate you coming in and telling like it is for us.
You're welcome, Tim, and I appreciate the opportunity, and love what you're doing with Officer.com. It's great. I look at it every day.
Hey, thanks very much. Nice to hear.
That's the podcast for this time. Keep watching the Officer.com homepage, where we'll post a link to the next installment as soon as it becomes available. Until then, keep your head down, keep your powder dry, and know that you're working at the best job in the world. Stay safe.